We were very proud to crown it our tournament winner, and now we're very excited to hear from the author. So I have a bio here for him, and sorry, I meant to double check this. Do you pronounce your last name Lou?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So Ken Liu is an American author of speculative fiction, a winner of the Nebula, Hugo, and World Fantasy Awards. He wrote The Dandelion Dynasty, a silkpunk epic fantasy series, starting with The Grace of Kings, as well as The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories, and The Hidden Girl and Other Stories. He also authored the Star Wars novel, The Legends of Luke Skywalker. Prior to becoming a full-time writer, Lou worked as a software engineer, corporate lawyer, and litigation consultant. Lou frequently speaks at conferences and universities on a variety of topics, including futurism, cryptocurrency, history of technology, bookmaking, mathematics of origami, and other subjects of his expertise. Right, so thank you so much for joining us today, Ken. Our short story tournament participants were so moved by your story, and we'd love to hear some background on it. I think all of us were in tears with both the pain and the beauty of the mother-son relationship you created. Can you tell us more about the process of writing that story and some of your inspiration for the ideas you had there?
So thank you very much, Lauren, and to everyone else from the Tournament Books group and also from elsewhere for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here to talk with all of you about the story. So as far as the inspiration for the story, it's a quirky story. What happened was at the time I wrote the story, I was writing a lot of short stories and submitting them everywhere for publication or trying to get published. I was not actually having a huge amount of success. There was a particular anthology that had a call for submissions, and the theme was wizards or magic users. And the way I approach themed anthologies and call for submissions like that is to not seize on the very first idea that comes to my mind. I want to wait around and try to think of multiple ideas, because in my experience, the first few ideas that you get when you're trying to write to a theme are almost always not great ideas, because you tend to fall back on cliches, you tend to be very influenced by other things you've read on that theme. So, you know, when you're thinking about wizards, the first few ideas that come to mind are almost always going to be not great ideas. So I just let the idea sort of come to me and, you know, batting them out off and saying, like, I don't want to do that. And then eventually, one particular idea came to me that I did think was actually very worth exploring. And that's because at the time, I had read a few personal narratives by women who would, in common parlance, be described as mail order brides. So they are women usually from developing countries who, for a variety of reasons, wish to improve their lives through these introduction services to be married to spouses, usually men, usually white men, in Western countries. So pejoratively, they're described as mail order bride, and the term has certain connotations in our culture. And the reality is, I think most people don't actually know much about the lives of these women. And so I was reading some of these personal narratives, and they're incredibly moving. The kind of courage it takes to completely abandon or, you know, change your life to take this leap to essentially remake yourself. I just found that whole idea absolutely overwhelming. And to read about how these women then their, I don't want to say struggles, because that implies a certain kind of narrative, and they're not all like that. To read about the experiences and just the fullness of their lives, it was really beautiful. And then at the same time, I was thinking about how, you know, there's a kind of everyday magic to very small things in our life that we don't often talk about. You know, if you think about it, so many things that happen on a daily basis are actually very magical. The very way that you can listen to someone talk and understand what they're saying, there's a huge amount of magic involved in there. Because think about it, right? When you're talking with someone and you're hearing them, what's happening is their vocal cords are literally vibrating in sympathy with your eardrums. That's how you can actually hear their words. There's an actual sympathy between your two bodies, connected by, mediated by air. That kind of communication, the idea that you can vibrate one part of your body and through the air cause a sympathetic vibration in someone else's body, and that the electrical signals in your brain will somehow be translated through those vibrations and causing an echo of electrical patterns in someone else's brain, and then they can actually understand you. That is telepathy. That's actual real telepathy that we go through on a daily basis. And we don't even show any appreciation for that kind of magic. It's astounding to me. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about these personal narratives about the so-called male order brides and by them. And I was like, okay, this is my story. I wanna create a story about a magic user who is one of these women. And it's about her story. It's about her life. It's about her courage. And this very, very primal experience we all have of being children and trying to learn and understand and appreciate the everyday magic that we all grow up with. And then at some point, you know, as you step into adulthood, that magic is gone for most of us. Only if we're very lucky do we get to hold on to it. So I said, okay, that's the story I'm gonna write. So I ended up writing The Paper Menagerie. And of course, you know, there's a little bit of a ironic coda to this. The story was not accepted by the anthology that I wrote it for. They did not think the story was appropriate. It was not a good fit. But the story ended up getting published elsewhere, and it ended up becoming one of my better known works early on in my career. So, you know, everything worked out for the best, even though the market I originally voted for rejected it. So to those of you who are writers, you know, there's a lesson there. Sometimes getting rejected can, in fact, be the best thing that happened to you. I'm pretty sure that had the story been published in the anthology that it was intended for, it wouldn't have gotten much notice. But then, you know, as a result, it got published in fantasy and science fiction. It was my debut work there. And it ended up getting much more notice as a result. So, hey, things happen for a reason.
That's so wonderful to hear. So just hearing you speak about the magic that happens every day does make me think about how much I appreciate. I have been digging into the other stories in that collection, and I feel like I'm learning so much on science and also history. Like, you weave those into your other stories. If anyone hasn't been reading his other stories yet, I do highly recommend them. So that's been really fun. I just, you know, come out from each one and be like, wow, I learned so much in that short amount of time. And another thing, this came up when, so there were two of us, me and Amy, who were kind of running things along for our tournament. And we were in the booth, the discussion booth for your story up against, let's see, it might have been when it was in the finals up against, Ted Chiang's Story of Your Life, which is another, are you familiar with that one?
Oh yeah, that is an incredible story. Yeah.
It was a hard decision, but yours still won. And one thing that we pointed out was whether you would categorize some of what was happening as magical realism. Like, is that something that people are supposed to see as supposed to be normal or supposed to be a little bit above and beyond? And I shared an experience that I had with another author, one who's local here in Austin, Texas, Natalia Sylvester. In her recent novel, Everyone Knows You Go Home, it incorporates the ghost of a family member. And she said that, so somebody asked her, like, oh, can you talk about magical realism? And she's like, I actually pushed back on that term a little bit because she's Peruvian, but spent most of her life in the Texas-Mexico border area, the valley. And she was like, in my culture, that is, you know, like communicating with ghosts of our family members and the way that we celebrate life, you know, even after it's over, is just normal. And I don't really want to give it that label of magic. But then I feel like, so I was wondering if that's something that makes sense to you, but I almost feel like you're on the other side of that, of the, of just there's magic every day, everywhere around us, and we can call it that and celebrate that. So I'm curious about your thoughts on those elements.
So I have lots to say in response to that, and I'll try to keep my remarks brief, because one of the things about writers is we all know that if you get them started, they'll never shut up. So I will try to be very cognizant of that fact. But these are such, you know, awesome questions. There's so much to say. One, I want to talk about genre and my relationship to genre, magic, sci-fi, etc. And the other is magic in our lives and belief. So the first part is I've had a very complicated relationship with genre labels. I think many of us go through this phase as writers where we want to be recognized for our originality, the ways in which we are just unique. We don't like being categorized and, you know, lumped into genre categories. The fact is, as a reader, I never really paid attention to genres. So when people ask me, you know, what do you like to read? I can't answer by saying I like, you know, science fiction or detective novels or whatever. Because that's actually not how I think about these books. I just like them because I like them. I don't think the genre labels mean much to me. So as a result of that, when I started writing fiction, I wasn't thinking specifically of writing in a genre. And I think that's the reason actually why The Paper Menagerie as a story originally wasn't a good fit for the anthology, because the anthology was specifically asking for fantasy stories. And I think the feeling is this story isn't actually very good fantasy. It's not, there's no magic system. there's no real attention being paid to genre tropes and genre conventions, because, you know, I didn't care about those. A lot of times the sort of stories I like to write are stories about making some aspect of reality that we speak of in a metaphorical sense commonly, to make those aspects literally true, okay? So as an example, we often talk about how love makes things alive or gives the world a brighter color or makes things more, feel somehow more real. We talk about that in a metaphorical sense, but you know, the way I would write a story like that is I would actually make it literally true. Like, you know, when you have love in your lives, literally there, the colors in your world are brighter, that when you have a mother's love, the paper animals literally do come to life. So that's how I went about it. I literalized some aspect of reality. So the closest genre label I would attach to that is magic realism, I guess. It's not fantasy in the traditional sense. So it doesn't really bother me that sometimes people really dislike the way I do things. And I think one critic early on wrote about my short fiction by saying that Ken has a habit of writing fantasy as though it were science fiction and writing science fiction as though it were fantasy. I think she intended this as some sort of insult, but I actually sort of really enjoyed it. I was like, that's kind of cool. That's a really nice bit of praise. I don't think she meant it as praise at all, but I really like that. So that's how I do it. I don't particularly care about genre labels. As far as the Paper Menagerie is concerned, I don't know what genre to put it in. I would call it probably magic realism. That's the closest thing. And I will say also that I've had to deal with this over the years many, many times. In the US, I think most folks are okay with the paper menagerie being what it is. I think the conversation in genre fiction in the US is such that readers, in my experience, most readers don't tend to be very obsessed with genre labels. They're okay with calling the story fantasy, they're okay with calling it speculative fiction, magic realism, whatever. But when the story is translated into other languages, sometimes fans in other countries can really get very hung up on this. I've had experiences of having the story translated into other languages and fans writing to me very angrily saying, how did you win all these sci-fi awards? This is not sci-fi at all. And I was sort of like, I never called it sci-fi. I don't know why you think it's sci-fi.
The award entities?
Well, I mean, you know, many of the awards like the Hugo and the Nebula and whatever, these are not restricted to sci-fi, right? They're awarded to works of fantastic literature. So, it doesn't bother anybody that, you know, I got nominated and won the Hugo. But I think for some fans who have an idea that these awards are reserved for science fiction, serious science fiction, the fact that I won the award was some sort of insult to their genre. So I get that kind of thing a lot, which is really comical to me. So anyway, that aside, on the issue of everyday magic, I've had a lot of I've done a lot of thinking and a lot of exploration into the idea of what does it mean when people say we believe something or when we don't believe something. So let me give you examples. I think this is actually true of everybody. So there's, of course, this idea. My grandmother on my mother's side, she's Cantonese. So there's this Cantonese belief that the number four is unlucky. Mm-hmm. Okay, because the number four in Cantonese is very similar to the word for death. So you don't want to live on the fourth floor. You don't want to have a license number that ends in four. It's not good. Okay, it's not lucky. So when I try to buy presents for her when she was alive, I would avoid having the number four in it. So now people ask you, do you believe the number four is unlucky? I don't know how to answer that. I don't personally believe that it's unlucky, because that seems like a superstition. But on the other hand, to deliberately buy something that ends in four for my grandmother seems like a gesture of great disrespect, okay? So similar to folks who say, I don't believe Friday the 13th had anything to do with it, but nonetheless, they wouldn't schedule their wedding or some celebration on Friday the 13th. Why? Is it because they sort of believe it, or is it because they do it out of a sense of respect for the community as a whole? My point is that for many of us, that's actually the way it is. Many of us don't do things because we personally have a strong commitment to the belief one way or the other. Many of us do things out of respect for how we think other people believe these things. So that's sort of the way I write a lot of my fiction too. Is it magic or not? I mean, The Paper Menagerie is one example. Through most of the story, you can actually take the position that the animals were never alive. They were alive just in Jack's imagination. That everything he was describing was literally only happening in his mind. They were never true. In fact, he himself takes that position later on when he was older. He says, I must imagine it. But of course, you know, there's one scene in which, depending on your perspective, that reading is turned upside down, because, you know, the paper tiger does come alive. It is true. There's no denying it. The way I wrote my epic fantasy is similar. My epic fantasy contains gods as characters, but if you read the book, I wrote it very carefully in such a way that if you are a committed atheist and you come into this book with a committed view that there are no such thing as gods, you can actually explain everything in the book where the gods appear as mere imagination of explanation of natural phenomena. I deliberately wrote it that way so that even the very existence of the gods in this world is open to question. I think that's actually a more accurate reflection of how most of us deal with the supernatural. We're not definitely committed to whether it's true or not, or sometimes maybe we do, but nonetheless, we behave as though some of these things can be true for the benefit of other people. Anyway, so that's kind of how I go about it and how I think about it.
Yeah, that's great information. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I, to me, the animals were alive. You know, I love kind of being open to different versions of reality and that magic or whatever you want to call it. But I know for some readers that's hard. You know, we want definite answers of, you know, is this what I can relate to? Is this my reality or not? One thing that's interesting, I have seen a couple people post that they're having trouble hearing me. I have found this on Zoom that about 10% of people don't hear me as well, and it happens for me on the other end as well, where there's like one person in the group. So I am speaking pretty loudly, and I moved my laptop with my microphone a little closer, but sorry about that. If you don't mind just kind of turning up and down, that's kind of how I do it when I have different levels, but I am trying to be as loud as possible without screaming. but anyway, so I was gonna say, when you're talking about genre, we noticed it was interesting in our short story tournament that not only your story, but just kind of the short story format in general can kind of help break people out of their typical genres or bend them in general, because our group is mostly a literary fiction group. Some of us, you know, that's the majority of what we read. Some of us would never, you know, go to specific science fiction, fantasy genres and read those entire novels. But we loved, and we noticed that I think about a third of our stories in the final, in the bracket, would fit into those categories in some way. And people were really surprised. They're like, oh, I don't see myself as a science fiction, fantasy reader, but this story is working for me. So I think that I really appreciate how you put so many stories out there. And I think that is a really good way to bring in new people who might, you know, be a little bit nervous about a novel length in a certain genre, but it really can bring in more people and kind of bend those labels, which you mentioned you're not thrilled about anyway. So,
well, you know, the way I think about it is the earliest stories that we absorb, both in terms of our cultural experience, in terms of our individual experience, are stories that fit into multiple genre categories or defy genre categorizations. I mean, you know, what are myths, right? What are, you know, when you take a story like Charlotte's Web, is it a work of fantasy? Is it a work of just pure imagination? Or is it more like a realist work? Or you take something like Winnie the Pooh, you know, what is it? You know, or you can even go very high, like Shakespeare, you know, many of Shakespeare's stories, like say The Winter's Tale or something like that, is that a work of fantasy or is it, you know, a realist literary work? I think like sometimes by paying attention to genre labels so much and trying to define genre fiction as in fact distinct from so-called literary fiction, I think we do ourselves a big disservice. At least that's my view. I just think like sometimes it might be better to just ignore that and then and try to think about what are the characteristics of fiction that we actually like are. And you know, for me, it's I tend to be drawn to narratives about literalizing some aspect of reality that is normally understood metaphorically. That's how I describe it. And whether the literalization happens through science, technology, pseudoscience, or fantasy, magic, doesn't really matter to me. I like stories that do that.
Right, definitely. Okay, so I do want to open it up to other folks' questions since we do have a lot of people that tuned in. I did receive a question that's a good one that I want to ask. It was sent to me in the chat, but it does pull us into some other things. Does anyone who's here have a question specifically about the Paper Menagerie before we switch to his other work? If you do, go ahead and unmute yourself and you can ask it, or you can type it into the chat here. There's a lot in the chat I need to catch up on.
Hi, Ken. Did you play with paper origami when you were a kid? Or did you try and make any of those animals while you were writing the story?
Oh, wow. Awesome question, by the way. So when I was a very small child, my grandmother was the one who taught me to do some origami early on. She did it not just with paper. She also taught me how to fold some animals out of handkerchiefs. So I learned how to do a mouse using handkerchiefs and how to do a little bird. And she taught me how to make a boat, a little penguin creature. And then later on, she got me a book that I went through trying to make each one of those. So the funny thing is, you know, I think origami is really what got me hooked onto my lifelong love for engineering and mechanical stuff. Because I don't know how many of you have tried to follow directions for origami, but the way, you know, these explanations work is you have to learn a whole vocabulary of specific folds and techniques. What does it mean to do this and that? And you have to learn to follow the directions exactly, otherwise it won't come out. Sometimes I have pictures, but, you know, before the days of YouTube, trying to learn how to do origami through pictures is actually very difficult because they can't show you the whole process. They can only show you one thing. And so you have to compare the two pictures and imagine your head. How did it go from this to this? What are the things you do in space to get this two-dimensional surface to do this three-dimensional movement and end up in that configuration? So learning to do that with my grandmother and with the book taught me a lot of, taught me that I actually seem to have a love for this kind of thing. I love the idea of following and imagining and trying to interpret very precise directions, learning a technical language, and trying to innovate, if you will, in that technical language. So all of my professions later on ended up being about that. You know, I was a software engineer, I was a lawyer, I was a litigation consultant, I ended up as a fiction writer. All of these techniques or all of these professions really involve learning to use techniques that are very much about mathematical precision, reducing complicated things into precise atomic steps, and trying to figure out how to go through the steps one after the other to achieve a specific result, to create very elaborate structures out of very simple components. I mean, origami, you know, they couldn't get simpler. You're really learning just a few very basic steps that you then layer on top of each other and combine and build on until you get to beautiful three-dimensional structures out of this two-dimensional thing. So anyway, my grandmother did give me this lifelong love for origami and by extension all the mechanical arts. And then later on, after my grandmother passed away, as a way to remember her as an adult, I went back into origami again and learned a lot about the mathematics behind it. Turns out origami principles are actually very widely applied in metamaterials, nanomaterials, space materials, the biology of plants, and all sorts of other areas. And there's even a whole branch of mathematics dealing with how origami can be a way to do proofs, much like the compass and the straight edge. And it turns out that using origami, you can do solve certain classical geometry proof problems, or construction problems that you cannot solve with just the compass and the straight edge. So anyway, I actually have a whole talk that I developed around origami and mathematics. So it is a real passion of my that I really love very deeply. So thank you for that question. Yeah.
Yeah, great question. I do see a few others that popped up here in the chat. One of them from Noah is, with the title, did you intend to evoke any kind of connection to Tennessee Williams' play, The Glass Menagerie?
So The Glass Menagerie is one of my favorite stories. Play, but you know, I think of it as a narrative. There is a connection, although it might not be obvious at first. The connection basically is that in both of these stories, the menagerie, whether it's glass or paper, is actually a way, a language, a way for the main character to reveal their inner world in a way that they cannot do through speech alone. In the same way that you know, speech alone is inadequate to express what's in their hearts, they end up having to use these glass animals or the paper animals to express something much deeper that they cannot say using words. So yes, there the title was indeed an homage to the Glass Menagerie, and that is the connection. I'm not sure how many people have commented on the connection specifically, but that was what was in my head as I wrote it.
Great, yeah, I'll need to check that out. I'll admit I'm not familiar with that, but now I'm very much interested. So another one from Jessica was, where did you read these first person accounts of mail order brides?
So it was on, this was in the early days. So they were on, I guess we would describe them as forums. So these are, so they're not devoted to, you know, the experiences of mail order brides. I think it was actually a forum, a technical forum, talking about some programming language. And, you know, there was, in most of these forums, there's some sort of area where you do miscellaneous discussion. So some of the enthusiasts started talking about just experience of their own families or their own experiences. So these are personal narratives about their own actual experience. So I just found it so moving. You know, one woman was talking about how she found everything so incomprehensible and difficult when she first moved to the US, and then she had to immediately run a whole family and household. And so she described her experience of learning how to cook in the mainstream Anglo-American style. And I just found that so moving. It was not something that I personally had experience with or knew anyone who had that kind of experience. I mean, only similar experiences, but nothing quite like that. So I was just like, wow, you know, I'm so glad I'm reading these and I'm understanding about other people's lives in a way that I would not have understood. So that's what happened.
Oh, great. So another question from Margaret. Can you talk about your thought process in completing the story? You spoke about mail order brides as inspiration. How did you decide to use origami and the Chinese American perspective as narrative? Was it a spontaneous or organic process as you started writing it, or was it by design? So you've answered a little bit of this, but there might be some more there.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was by design. I'm not, so, you know, some writers are very, very meticulous about plotting out and planning out the whole vision before they write. I was never like that. I'm one of those writers who kind of just starts writing because there's some sort of image, some idea in my head that I found compelling. So I start writing, and the way I think about it is it's sort of like whittling or, you know, carving a sculpture out of a block. I just sort of chisel and play with it and see what happens when I just keep on playing with the idea. I mean, my first drafts are often incredibly messy, and I don't even call them first drafts. I call them negative first drafts, because they're not even really coherent. They're just, you know, ideas I put down there, very rough sketches of what I was playing with. I have to actually do the writing to understand what I'm writing. I have to actually explore the idea by writing the story. I can't just sit there abstractly thinking about the story and plotting it out. Just some writers are like that, and I'm not one of them. So for the Paper Menagerie, the process really involved me just playing with the idea. I was like, okay, let's try to tell the story from the mother's point of view. What is it? You know, let's do it as a first person narrative. What is it? And then I was like, okay, I can't quite get that right. That doesn't sound right. That's not what I think is really interesting about the story. So the son came later as a secondary character. And then I said, okay, sometimes the most effective way is to not tell the story directly because she can't. Her problem is she cannot find the language to tell the story that she wants to tell. So maybe the way to go about it is to not go at it directly. Tell the story of how her life influenced someone else, how someone else did fail to understand her story only until it's too late. Maybe go about it that way. So I played around with that idea, and I wrote the whole story that way. And then, you know, I said, oh, actually, this is too literal. I'm doing this in too literal way. Is there some way I can bring the magic in? What is the metaphorical thing that I can do to make it literally true, to explain, to really show instead of tell this part of the story? And that's when the origami animals came. And so I said, okay, this is the way to go. So, you know, it was not planned. It was not by design. Everything was very organically built together. I went step by step. I tweaked a little bit here, carved a little piece there, added this, took that away, until eventually I got to the point where I felt, okay, this makes some sense. This is cool. This is actually really working. So at that point, I started whittling away all the pieces that didn't fit until I got to something that felt more like a zeroth draft, meaning this is a draft that actually has the story in it. And then, you know, that's the point at which I start to go over there and start doing all the writerly stuff, you know, getting the point of view correct, getting the language in, figure out what is the best place to break scenes, what is the angle from which a scene should be written, etc., until I get to a first draft, which is, you know, what other writers would have as their first draft, the actual draft that you can, you know, show people. So that's my process. It's super messy, but it works for me. I've always been doing things that way. I did try very hard to outline and try to plan out a whole story before doing it. And my experience has always been that if I actually somehow force myself to go through that whole process, I just don't want to write the story anymore. I have this outline and all the fun has been taken out of it. I don't want to write the story anymore. There's no exploration. There's no joy in it. I just don't write it. So I actually have stories that I've outlined that I feel zero interest in writing because the whole thing feels so dead to me. There's no life to it. You know, it's just a piece of paper. There's no way to breathe life into it. So I just don't bother. They just sit there. So I know myself well enough now to not plot. I cannot plan and outline and do things that way. It just does not work. So I just don't do it.
Wow, that's great to know. And I always appreciate, as a new creative writer, and there are probably other writers in here, just hearing about all of the work that goes on behind the scenes. You know, we see this finished product and we just imagine you sitting down and just typing it out, you know, as it is, and like, oh wow, you know, it must be so easy for some people to come up with these beautiful stories, but it's really not. You know, you really made it clear how much work, the messiness of it. And
oh yeah, I'm pretty sure that for most writers you end up writing so many more words than actually end up appearing on the page. I mean, you know, my epic fantasy novels are very big, so people are like, oh, you know, that must be a very different experience. It's not. I end up writing, you know, something like 5 to 10 times more words than actually appear in the final book. Most of it just has to be thrown away. It's the way it is.
Right. So I do want to jump to a question that was posted really early, just so it doesn't get lost in the chat here. Let's see. Okay, so this is from Zach. So he says, hi Ken, I love this story and actually teach it to my students here in mainland China. In addition to your original work, I really enjoyed reading your translations of The Three Body Problem and Invisible Planets. Were there any unique challenges for Invisible Planets, given that your translations for different authors were to appear next to each other?
Well, I'll just be very brief about this. I mean, that's a topic that could go on forever. Yeah, there's lots of challenges. I mean, translation is really not at all like writing. It's a very different thing. Basically, you're trying to, you know, figure out the best way to express someone else's voice in a new language. And that is, I mean, people often think of translation as some sort of semantic thing. It's really not. It has very little to do with what it means. It has much more to do with how it feels. Mm-hmm. So that's really an artistic pursuit. And so, you know, the challenge there is to, how do you do it in a way that stays true to everyone's original intent? So if you play music, maybe the analogy will make more sense. It's about playing a bunch of pieces from different composers. How do you actually, in your playing, express the differences you feel behind their work? as you read the music. That's basically what I had to do.
Yeah. Nice, that's great. So I'm going to ask just one more that was sent to me early from someone who might not be able to make it, but we'll review the recording. They had an emergency come up, and then we'll go back to more folks on here. So this is from Brittany Eschenbach. And they're asking, at the intro to the Paper Menagerie collection, you talk about the way your brain works differently when it's writing short stories versus novels versus translating versus other types of writing. Could you expand on that a bit? I'm curious to hear more about how you have to shift when writing for these different avenues. How does working on one writing format change your other writing format?
There's no real simple answer to any of this. I mean, it's humans are messy, creative pursuits are messy, so everything is messy. The way I would describe the difference between short fiction and big long novels is that they are really fundamentally different creatures with different body plans, and you have to sort of respect that. So a short story is more like a mosquito, and a epic fantasy novel is more like an elephant, and you cannot really take a mosquito and just proportionally blow it up to the size of an elephant and expect to have a viable creature. That's the closest the best way I can describe it. I started out as a short fiction writer. That was, you know, how I learned my craft. So when I started writing novels, I thought, okay, you know, I've written so many 1,000 word stories. Surely if I just do that 100 times, I would have 100,000 word novel. That cannot possibly be that difficult. Everything just gets blown up 100 times, right? Turns out that does not work. In the same way, you take a mosquito and you blow it up to the size of an elephant, it would just die. You know, it can't breathe. It doesn't. Insects absorb air, you know, passively through spiracles. They don't have lungs, and so you blow it up to that size. Simple physics will cause it to suffocate because volume increases much faster than surface area. You also would have the issue of it collapsing on itself because an exoskeleton cannot be blown up to that size and support the mass. Anyway, same thing in a short story. You blow it up to that size. Many of the techniques that I was used to in short stories would just not work in a novel form. Short stories don't actually rely on plot that much. I mean, this is somewhat surprising, but it's true. Short stories maintain their tension and their narrative drive in lots of ways, but plot is not always the most important part. And in fact, many short stories succeed by having no plot whatsoever. I've written multiple short stories that have been very well regarded and that I've been very satisfied with that contain no plot. Like the story that begins the Paper Menagerie collection, it's called The Bookmaking Habits of Select Species. It's just a list of descriptions. There's no plot. There aren't any characters even. You cannot do a novel in that way. You do a novel that way and it will be read by one person, you. So that's something that I had to learn, that lots of things that work okay in short fiction, that you can be very experimental, you can get away with doing things that way because readers are willing to pay attention to these other things and allow themselves to be entertained for 5 to 10 minutes in that way, does not mean they're willing to sit around for 8 hours to endure it in the form of a novel. They just can't. You cannot sustain the reader's interest or get them to stay with you using these techniques. So I had to learn a whole new way of thinking. I had to learn what it means to actually have a plot, to think through what it means to have narrative drive. It doesn't mean though that you have to learn how to outline and write everything that way. Again, there are people who will tell you that you have to do things that way to have a tight novel. Well, okay, I mean, they're entitled to that opinion. I never did it that way, and it's okay. You can write a novel and you can have good plot in the accumulative, experimental, sculpture-driven, tweaking way that I do it. You just have to be willing to come back to it later on and do a lot of revisions, which is, you know, what I've learned to do. So I would say that, you know, when I'm writing short fiction versus novels, I do have very different mindsets. I know that when I'm doing a short story, I just want to get one idea across. I just want to do one plot line. I just want to do one or two characters. There's a key core relationship and a very few key scenes I want to get through. And there's a very concentrated idea I want to get across. That's it. A novel is very different. I have to think about how to sustain the reader's interest over a much longer period of time and how to keep all the balls in the air, for lack of a better term, and trying to figure out how to make the world as much a part of the story as the characters themselves. So it is a different challenge. I wouldn't say I enjoy one more than the other, but you know, I will say that, you know, writing an epic fantasy novel like I was doing meant that I had to immerse myself in this imaginary world for a whole decade to do the whole series. And I don't think I've ever done any project that required me to devote a whole decade of my life to it, other than my children and my marriage, I guess. So, you know, it's at that level. Committing to an epic fantasy series is like that. So I guess if you're willing to, if you think you're ready to have kids, you might be ready to do your epic fantasy. That's how I think about it.
Right, you have to be really dedicated to those new worlds. that's great. Other folks on the call, do you want to jump in and unmute yourself to ask? Or I can also check if there are more questions in the chat. Feel free to jump in here.
Is it okay if I ask a question about the Dandelion Dynasty? Because we're kind of talking about that.
Sure.
So, hey, Ken, I'm John. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
So one of the questions I had, so you did say that The Veiled Throne, you've already finished it and it's coming out next year. We kind of started talking about it. Do you have any idea what your like next large scale book series is going to be about? Because you kind of talked about that decade mentality.
excellent question. So here's what's happening. I can show you the books. So hold on one second. Let me get the printed manuscript. Okay. So you're gonna get a sneak preview of how the series is going to end. So I originally planned the Dandelion Dynasty as a trilogy. And I actually wrote the last book as a single book. So here's what it looks like. This is the first half of the manuscript, okay? This is the second half of the manuscript, okay? So my editor informed me that it is not possible to put this into a single book. It's actually not possible. I mean, it is if you want to use really tissue thin paper and print them the way, you know, some copies of the Bible does with tiny print. I don't think that's an experience I wanted to give my readers. So what we're doing is we're going to break that third volume into two separate books. And it's going to be The Veiled Throne and Speaking Bones. So together, the four books will be the whole arc. And that's the entirety of the Dandelion Dynasty. It took me a whole decade to write it. You know, when I started it, my oldest daughter was literally a newborn. That's when I started writing it. She's now an accomplished gymnast a decade later. So I can literally see, you know, how I've changed, how my life has changed from the beginning, from The Grace of Kings to the last book, Speaking Bones. It really is a huge amount of my life. I sometimes feel like this whole series is like my third child in some ways. And I watched it grow up in the same way my kids have grown. So am I ready to do that again? I mean, you can, you know, ask people with kids, you know, when their kids have reached the age of 10, are they ready to have another one? My answer will be not quite. I need a little bit of a break. So I'm not going to do another big series, not right away, maybe even not for a while. I have ideas for standalone novels that I want to do. I've learned, I mean, my agent sometimes tell the joke that he's only ever sold one thing for me in the entire time we've been together, because it's this one series. I mean, you know, it's an exaggeration. He sold lots of other short things, but in terms of actual big things, this is it. So I'm ready to take a step back from creating giant worlds that I have to immerse myself in for a decade. I want to do something standalone. I think it would be kind of cool to write a novel of, you know, 80,000 words or so. And that's it. That's the story. Something very focused, not on a sprawling family, a whole world. Something very self-contained and distinct, and you can hold in your head all at once. I haven't actually done that before. I've never written an 80,000 word novel. So I think it will be kind of fun and a good challenge for myself to try to do it.
Awesome. Yeah, that's, I can definitely understand that. And I actually didn't know, I had thought that there was going to be two books, because I had seen like a post that you made on like Twitter or something, and it was so big. And I know like 1500 pages really the max for manuscript.
I was given various different information, but the bottom line is they cannot physically make a book this big and still expect to have a good experience for readers. It's just not going to happen. So we're doing the responsible thing and breaking into two books.
Awesome. And do you think that, are they going to be released simultaneously? Is there going to be the third one and then like a year off and then another one?
I know. Now, that's what I would prefer. That's going to wreak havoc to publishers. I mean, they have schedules, they have release schedules, and you cannot push that on them. You're telling them to just do an extra book. That's just not going to work. So they're going to do their best to try to put the two books out as close to one another as possible, but likely there will be a gap between them of some 9 months up to a year or something. So there's going to be, unfortunately, a real cliffhanger right in the middle, you know, because I wrote this whole thing as one book. So you're literally dividing it right in the middle. So it's going to be a cliffhanger, and hopefully readers will be patient enough to wait until the last one comes out and read the whole thing.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, that's great to know. And I definitely look forward to reading the standalone novel that you come up with as well. I did find a question in the chat from Michael. And it just jumped away. Okay, so he said, I really enjoyed the last story in Paper Menagerie and the questions of interpreting history. Was this subject of memory particularly on your mind when you were writing Paper Menagerie?
It's not, surprisingly. My thinking on memory and history has evolved quite a bit since the time I wrote those two stories. I mean, the stories in the Paper Menagerie really do come from a much earlier part of my career. So in some ways, when I look back on it, I know for a fact I cannot write some of those stories now. I'm just a different person. So for example, The Man Who Ended History, I was able to write that story when I was younger because I was in some ways much more resilient, I guess you could say. So I think a lot of you probably have this experience. When you're much younger, you can deal with reading narratives of torture and suffering, especially crimes committed against children, much more easily than later on when you become a parent. I actually can no longer read some of those stories. It's just too much. So when I was younger, The Man Who Ended History is about war crimes and real historical atrocities. And I do believe that all of us have a duty to face up to history, to witness it. This is very relevant right now in this moment where we're trying to come to terms with our own history in this country and the legacy of racism and trying to, it's like one of those things where if you don't pay attention, you can just go on about your lives. But when you start paying attention, you cannot. And we're finally doing it in this country, and that's great. But when I was writing The Man Who Ended History, I was trying to bear witness to history and trying to confront these real atrocities. I could write about it. And it really, really was psychologically horrific. You know, one of the things I needed to do was to actually understand the deniers. So the folks who deny these war crimes committed by the Japanese Imperial Army are very similar to Holocaust deniers. So just imagine yourself trying to immerse yourself in a forum full of Holocaust deniers and trying to understand their perspective and understand why they think the way they do. It's probably going to mess you up. It's going to really do it. You know, when I was trying to write the story, I believe very deeply that you have to actually write about the people who hold these views. You have to understand them in order to write them in a way that feels true, because in order to reveal the truth, you have to actually understand why those who would deny the truth actually would do it. So I spent a lot of energy in these forums talking to the folks who were deniers, and you know, it's very difficult as a ethnic Chinese to these people. I am less than human. You know, the if you're Korean or Chinese and you come on these forums, you are less than human. You know, they come to you and explain why all the talk about the war crimes of the Japanese Imperial Army are lies, never happened, and you know, it's the same set of techniques used by conspiracy theorists, by Holocaust deniers, by the folks who point to Black Lives Matter and say this is all Russian agitators. It's same kind of thing. You just have to live through that. I went through it, and I gotta say, you know, they managed to make me want to kill myself. I almost committed suicide having to do this. So that's the kind of thing I could deal with when I was in my 20s, and I was resilient and I could deal with it. Now I can't write a story like that anymore. I can't do the research. I cannot go to the Library of Congress and read through the narratives of the war criminals about the experiments they did, the dissections, the vivisections, the torture they inflicted. I cannot look at those photographs. I cannot read through the transcripts of the war crimes trials. I cannot read the testimony and the accounts of survivors. I just can't. I can't do it anymore. So now I thinking back to what I went through to write that story, it was a different writer, somebody who is much stronger in some ways, and less less wise to the darkness of the human heart, if you will. At my age, I no longer want to do that. So in some ways, it's interesting to look back on the Paper Menagerie and other stories, because it does record the writings and the thinkings of a different writer, of a very different person from me. Now I try to tell different stories. I try to my commitment to, you know, to truth, to history, and to hope, you know, that has not changed. But what I can endure and what I can think about and what I can write, that has changed. I think we all evolve over time into different kind of writers, and it's not better or worse. It just is. There are some stories left for our younger selves to do, and other stories that are better for those of us who are older. I couldn't have possibly written about parent-child relationship the way that I do now back then either, because I didn't really know what it meant to love a child, to love your child. Now I do. So that's a way in which I think I've changed for the better.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I will say I'm very grateful that you have recognized how you need to take care of yourself as a writer and what, you know, you can no longer go into. And, you know, you bring such a wonderful gift to the world. And so I absolutely hope you'll continue taking care of yourself and, you know, doing what works for you and, you know, not having to do something that's painful for other people. So it looks like we are about out of time. There are still some good questions in the chat. Is there a good way that folks could reach out to you, not with high expectations of a quick response, but just you know, for these people that have some pretty good questions here, is there some way
that you can always, you know, follow me on Twitter and subscribe to my newsletter because I announce new events there all the time. So if you go to my website, which is kenlu.name, kenliu.name, and you can sign up for my newsletter there. I try to do virtual events fairly regularly now as a way to stay in touch with my readers. My website contains a lot of information. I've done a lot of interviews and there are links to those. So chances are your questions might be answered in one of those places too. I'm always happy to hear from readers. I can't promise to answer everyone, unfortunately, but you know, you're always welcome to write to me. I love hearing from readers because this is a pretty lonely job. You write and you throw your words out there and you have no idea if people are reading it or if they what they feel. So to the extent that you want to write to me and tell me how you feel, I love that. And I even recognize some of the names in the chat right now because I've heard from some of you via email before. Great. So it's really cool to actually see you virtually. And hopefully we'll get to connect again, perhaps even in person, once we can start traveling and do in-person conventions again. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. And of course, definitely check out his latest collection if you can, The Hidden Girl and Other Stories. I'm very excited to get into this as soon as I finish the other collection. So I'm really grateful for your time, Ken. I wish you the best, and I look forward to following everything you're working on, and just grateful for you. And you have a lot of other positive messages of gratitude in the chat here.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it, everyone. Good luck, and hope all of you have a good rest of Sunday.
Thank you so much. You too. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Thanks so much for coming.
Thank